Hello and welcome to the reading of the Cedar Rapids Gazette for today. No fooling, it's Thursday, April 1st. I'm your reader, Kathleen. First, a little look at the April outlook for weather. As we kick off the month of April, we continue our stretch of sunny, dry weather with warming temperatures into the weekend. April begins with average highs in the mid-50s, climbing to an average high to the mid-60s by the end of the month. Forecast temperatures in the short term appear to be well above this, topping out in the low to mid-70s this weekend, thanks to strong southerly winds bringing in warmer air. Slightly above average temperatures look to continue for the next few weeks, with the month as a whole likely above average. Our April showers are expected to be near normal, with equal chances of above and below average precipitation for the month. And from the front page of the Gazette today, Democrat Hartz drops U.S. House dispute. This story by Tom Barton for the Quad City Times. Nearly 5 months after the election, Democrat Rita Hart withdrew her contest Wednesday, asking Congress to investigate Republican U.S. Representative Marionette Miller Meek's 6-vote win of Southeast Iowa's 2nd Congressional District. Despite our best efforts to have every vote counted, the reality is that the toxic campaign of political disinformation to attack this constitutional review of the closest congressional contest in 100 years has effectively silenced the voice of Iowans, Hart said in a statement. It is a stain on our democracy that the truth has not prevailed, and my hope for the future is a return of decency and civility. The news came just hours after U.S. House Minority Leader Kevin McCarthy came to Davenport to show support for Miller Meeks and decry Democrats' attempts to potentially overturn the state-certified results in one of the closest federal races in U.S. history. And it follows weeks of persistent House GOP attacks and fundraising efforts, attacking Hart's challenge as an effort to steal the election as part of the power grab to pad House Democrats' narrow majority. The National Republican Congressional Committee began airing ads this week targeting Iowa's lone Democrat in Congress, U.S. Representative Cindy Axne, over a House panel's ongoing review of the 2nd District outcome. Some moderate House Democrats in competitive districts in recent weeks have expressed reservations at the prospect of the democratically controlled House reversing a state-certified election and unseating Miller Meeks. Particularly, some said, after bashing Republicans for trying to overturn President Donald Trump's electoral defeat to President Joe Biden. It's been counted, recounted, and a bipartisan election board had voted who certified the razor-thin results, McCarthy told reporters in Davenport before Hart's announcement. It's time to move on. Miller Meeks, a former state senator from Ottumwa, edged Hart, a former state senator from Wheatland, by 6 votes out of nearly 400,000 cast in the November 3 election. The seat was last held by Dave Loebsack, an Iowa City Democrat who retired. Hart's campaign was challenging the results, claiming that 22 ballots were legally cast but not counted following a district-wide recount in all 24 counties due to errors by election workers. Miller Meeks and Republicans argued Hart should have taken up any issues in Iowa courts, not the U.S. House. States and state law needs to guide elections, Miller Meeks told a radio audience following the news of Hart's withdrawal. We all know the rules, and we all should have to play by the rules, not change the rules if we don't get the result we need. Hart argued she did not go through the courts because Iowa election laws does not offer enough time for a sufficient appeal process. Providing roughly a week for a panel of judges to hear the case, establish rules of evidence, and potentially another recount of the entire district. Hart's campaign argued that Iowa law prevented legally cast but wrongly rejected ballots from being included in the count. Iowa code states recount boards may consider only ballots considered by county canvass boards, even if made aware of legally cast ballots excluded from the initial count. Hart also argued the process was marred by discrepancies and inconsistencies in how ballots were examined from county to county. Since Election Day and throughout this entire process, My mission has been about ensuring the voices of Iowans who followed the law are not silenced, Hart said in her statement. I am saddened that some Iowans' votes will not count through no fault of their own. The work of ensuring it does not happen again will continue beyond this campaign, Miller Meeks said in a statement. She thanked Hart for ending the challenge. I know how extremely difficult it is to lose an election, but for the people to have faith and confidence in the system and Iowa's laws, it was gracious of her to concede at this time, said Miller Meeks, who has been serving provisionally in the House while the contest continued. I look forward to continuing to work to represent the people of Iowa's 2nd District. Miller Meeks called the end of the contest a tremendous relief as she arrived at the vaccination clinic at the Washington County Department of Public Health. She said Hart did the right thing rather than drag the whole country through another contentious process. Nonetheless, Miller Meeks acknowledged the election results show an evenly divided district. We are about as evenly divided as you can get, she said. For those people who supported me, it's a relief and validation for them. For those who did not support me, I will work hard to be a congresswoman for everybody in the 2nd District. Also on the front page this morning, UI Children's Hospital needs millions in window fixes. This by Vanessa Miller. Just 4 years after University of Iowa Healthcare opened its 14-story, $392.7 million Stead Family Children's Hospital, and after design changes and cost overruns pushed the project $122 million over budget, the hospital is asking to spend another $10 to $15 million to replace two floors of windows. If the State Board of Regents next week approves replacing windows on floors 4 and 5 of the Children's Hospital and on the connector bridge leading to the main UIHC campus, it will swell the project's total cost to over $407 million. That price still does not include costs for consulting and assessments to determine which windows pose a risk and the cause of the deficiencies. It also excludes temporary measures to keep visitors safe. We were just noticing some cracking in a few isolated windows, and when we saw them in more than a few windows, then we hired an outside firm to come in and make sure it's okay, UI Hospitals and Clinics Chief Executive Officer Suresh Gunasekaran told the Gazette. After the issue was first seen in 2019, the consultant identified manufacturer deficiencies in only certain types of windows of the Children's Hospital, meaning most, including those in patients' rooms, are not affected. The hospital last summer installed a protective film over windows of concern and in 2019 closed the hospital's playground among its preventive measures. As soon as we thought there might be an issue with similar windows, we wanted to close the playground out of an abundance of caution, Gunasekaran said. We didn't actually think the playground was at risk, but we just wanted to be on the safe side. In addition to the windows cracking, hospital officials noticed blemishes and delamination when an adhesive bond between two plates of glass started to separate. In the UIHC request for region approval to spend $10 to $15 million, officials report they found enough issues to raise concern about the long-term performance of the window systems. Although UIHC doesn't believe windows on other floors pose a risk and that affected windows are secured by the protective film, officials are actively monitoring all windows while a permanent solution is determined. UIHC didn't immediately provide the cost of applying that protective film, manufactured by 3M and expected to last a couple of years. The campus also didn't immediately provide the name of the firm that conducted the risk assessment and is looking into the cause of the problem, or how much it's paying for those services. Officials have told the board they plan to use UIHC building usage funds to cover the replacement costs, although Gunasekaran said the campus is looking into insurance options and whether the windows are still under any sort of warranty. We're presently investigating all of that, he said, but added UIHC wanted to get started on the bidding process now. That was really our broad thought on this. It's let's get going. but at the same time, we're still talking to the vendors who originally did this to figure out who's going to ultimately end up paying for it. Although a consultant continues to evaluate the deficiencies, Gunasekaran said, they have nothing to do with the hospital's design or structure. We have a definite root cause that it has something to do with the fabrication and manufacturing of the window itself, he said. We've completely excluded that this has something to do with the children's hospital structure. Gunasekaran said the campus didn't initiate a replacement sooner because officials didn't immediately know what was causing the problem. Initially, we actually thought that this might have something to do with something hitting the windows, he said. Among the times UIHC came back to its governing board for more money on the hospital, which it started in 2013, was in September 2015, when administrators wanted to add millions for a variety of safety enhancements that included a robust window system. The system, according to documents, was designed and tested to assure its integrity would not be compromised during severe weather events, such as a tornado or straight-line winds. Each patient room now also incorporates two protective automatic shades that have the proven capability of containing shards of glass associated with debris projected at the equivalent of EF3 wind speed. Gunasekaran said those upgrades are not tied to the deficiencies. The hospital also had to return to the board for more money years after it opened due to extensive and contentious litigation stemming from the project's thousands of midstream design changes, delays, and project mismanagement, revealed in a 2018 investigation by the Gazette. A judge eventually ruled against the university and forced it to pay contractors more than $30 million. That court order meant UIHC had to return to the board to request another cost hike, this time from $360.2 million to $392.7 million. Although the project predates Gunasekaran's arrival, he said his team has learned from the Children's Hospital and since has embarked on a string of construction projects that finished on budget and on time. Since the Children's Hospital project, he said, the university and UIHC have implemented a new construction process. We have utilized a new process where we are far more diligent in terms of how we organize ourselves, in terms of working with contractors, and also how we've improved communication with our vendors, he said. So we feel like we're in a better place, but we're really disappointed also that we've had to find this. Also on the front page, Reynolds, Iowa ready to open up vaccines. This story by Aaron Murphy. In just a few days, over 1.2 million Iowans who have not already started or finished getting a COVID-19 vaccine will become eligible. The state and its local partners are ready, Governor Kim Reynolds said Wednesday. On March 17, the governor announced the state's plan to open, starting Monday, vaccine eligibility to all Iowans who are old enough, not just to groups who have been declared priorities in early phases. Wednesday, Reynolds said that plan remains on track and that her administration, county public health departments, medical providers, pharmacies, and other entities involved in distributing the vaccine are prepared to handle what surely will be a surge in Iowans wanting to make appointments. When I'm out visiting the clinics, everyone I've been to so far have said, we can scale this. We've got a system. We can get people in our communities and surrounding areas taken care of. So if you send us more vaccine, I guarantee we can get it in the arms of Iowans, Reynolds said. I'm confident that we can do it. Certainly the will is there, and they've put a lot of work into taking care of the residents in their communities. It's really inspiring. The state previously designated the vaccine for populations most at risk of contracting the disease or suffering the worst symptoms. The rollout started with healthcare workers, then moved in succession to long-term care residents and staff. Residents 65 years or older, first responders, teachers and school staff, food processing, agricultural production and manufacturing workers, individuals living at home with disabilities, and finally, any residents with underlying health conditions. On Monday, all other eligible voters will be able to get the vaccine. Reynolds cautioned that demand likely will far exceed the state's supply, so securing an appointment will be especially difficult in some areas. But in some counties, vaccinations are running smoothly enough that they already have made doses available to all. With increasing vaccine supply and expanded assistance for those who need it, I am confident that everyone who wants to be vaccinated will have a chance to do so, Reynolds said. I think the future looks pretty good for getting Iowans vaccinated. More than 18% of the state's population over age 16 has been fully vaccinated, making it the 8th highest rank in the nation, according to the New York Times Federal Data Tracker, or the 10th highest rate, according to a similar Washington Post Data Tracker. Iowa has the 6th best rate of doses administered, 85%, according to the Times. Reynolds and Interim State Public Health Director Kelly Garcia implored Iowans to get vaccinated as soon as they're able. Both noted a recent increase in new COVID-19 cases, hospitalizations, and deaths. Reynolds said her administration is monitoring the small increases, which come on the heels of significant reductions after a deadly winter surge. Reynolds said her administration does not yet see evidence of another significant surge. Nonetheless, Garcia encouraged Iowans to remain vigilant in helping to limit the virus's spread. She said some of the increase in new cases can be attributed to spring break travel and more contagious variants. For all of these reasons, it remains critically important to follow all the mitigation efforts that we've taken over the past year, Garcia said, reiterating the key pandemic public health guidelines of staying home when sick and socially distancing in public. We now have key tools to stop the spread, and we must use them. Moving over to the Iowa Today page, the Coralville City Engineer retires after 35 years, this by Lee Hermiston. You'd be hard-pressed to find a corner of Coralville that Dan Holderness hasn't touched. Thanks to the community's growth and his nearly 35 years as city engineer, he's Coralville's longest-tenured employee, Holderness has had a hand in many large infrastructure projects. That list includes work on the city's water plant twice, redoing the wastewater plant twice, two new water towers, and rebuilding the Highway 6 and First Avenue intersection three times. On top of that, Holderness helped the city respond to four floods and oversaw more than $70 million in flood improvements after 2008. His work with the Environmental Protection Agency's Brownfields program paved the way for the Iowa River Landing development. Wastewater system, water system, streets, trails, our green spaces, every one of those had Dan's imprint. Coralville City Administrator Kelly Hayworth said, all of those things are a city engineer's dream, but the fact that Dan did it multiple times because of our growth is what's really unusual. I've been fortunate to be involved in a lot of major developments in the city, said Holderness, who retired Wednesday. I think it's time for someone else to take over. A native of Millersburg and a graduate of Iowa State University, Holderness was hired as Coralville's city engineer in July 1986, after working for a consulting firm and the city of Iowa City. Holderness said he was attracted to the diversity of the job, getting to be involved in road and sewer projects, parks and trails, and development review. In Coralville, Holderness saw a community poised for growth. Its population was around 6,000 at the time and has now grown to roughly 23,000. Under Holderness, the city has received 14 EPA grants, the fifth most in the country, to assess properties that were contaminated and difficult to develop. Through those $2.5 million grants, the city transformed a former industrial site into the Iowa River Landing, which represents an investment of $460 million in public and private funds. Without those investigational studies and improvements, Coralville Mayor John Lundell said, nothing would be built down there. About $70 million worth of improvements that now protect Coralville, up to 1 foot above the 2008 flood, also were implemented under Holderness's leadership. Hayworth said Holderness used real-time flood data in June 2008 to figure out how to protect the city against future flooding. In the middle of the floods, while a lot of us, Dan included, were fighting the flood, he was planning, how can we fix this? By October 2008, Coralville had a flood mitigation strategy in place. Dan came up with the plan, Hayworth said. He was just a steady force through the whole thing. He never got excited. Holderness credits the consistency in leadership in Coralville from Hayworth and other department heads and elected officials, many of whom have decades of experience with the city. You build a level of trust, Holderness said. I think it really fosters a high quality of development in the city. It helps us move forward better and more efficiently. Holderness will be succeeded as city engineer by Scott Larson, the assistant city engineer who has been with the office since 1993. In retirement, Holderness said he looks forward to traveling with his wife once the pandemic subsides and looking after his mother, who still lives on the family farm in Millersburg. He hopes he's remembered in Coralville as someone who led responsible development and brought new and exciting things to the city. I'm really going to miss the people, he said. I'm sure here for a while when I hear the bulldozers fire up, I'm going to miss being involved in the activities. And also on the Iowa Today page, this article by Aaron Jordan, boat operators required to wear engine cutoff switch. New circle of death rule applies to federal waterways, but could be coming for the state too. Boaters hope they never see a riderless boat circling in the water. It's called the circle of death, and it often means the driver fell overboard, leaving the motor running and couldn't escape the circling vessel. They could be in the middle of this and they can't get away, and the propeller cuts them and causes their death, said Susan Stocker, Iowa Department of Natural Resources Boating Law Administrator and Education Coordinator. A new federal law that goes into effect today requires boat operators to use an engine cutoff switch, if their boat has one, on federal waterways, which include Coralville Lake, Sailorville Lake, Lake Rathbun, and Lake Red Rock, as well as the Mississippi and Missouri rivers. Iowa law already requires people on personal watercraft, such as jet skis, to use kill switches, and Stocker said she expects Iowa soon will require boaters also to use these devices. I feel it's a safety measure we can all get behind, she said. Stocker hasn't seen the circle of death herself, but there are plenty of videos on YouTube. The spiral can be started if a boat operator releases the steering wheel or column while the boat still is powered. The rotating propeller blades create torque, causing the motor to turn sharply in the direction of the blades. The boat then starts turning the opposite direction, which can throw the driver or other passengers. It's a challenge because even if the operator is safe, there's hardly anything you can do to get the boat to stop until it runs out of gas, Stocker said. An engine cutoff switch is connected to the boat driver through a coiled cord clipped to the life jacket, wrist, or belt, Stocker said. There also are electronic kill switches that use transponders instead of a cord, but both will stop the engine if the driver is thrown from the boat or falls down suddenly within the boat. Engine cutoff switch links have been Coast Guard required equipment on powerboats since late 2019, and most boats built since 2013 have them. If an engine cutoff switch was not manufactured with the boat, the customer is not required to have one installed, Stocker said. Seven states, Alabama, Arkansas, Illinois, Louisiana, Nevada, New Jersey, and Texas already have this law for state water bodies. Stocker thinks it's likely, too, that this year for the Iowa legislature to pass a law requiring engine cutoff switches to be used on state waters, but she expects future legislation. Certainly in the future, we'll look to have this on all waters, she said. Moving now to the Insight page, the Gazette's own editorial is titled, More Vaccines Are Coming. Vaccine availability is set to surge in Iowa in the next few weeks. Now we have to connect all those shots to suitable arms. More than 1.5 million COVID-19 vaccine doses have been administered in Iowa, and around 600,000 Iowans have been fully vaccinated as of this week, according to the state's COVID-19 dashboard. That is a remarkable figure less than 4 months after Iowa received its first shipment of vaccine. However, the early doses may have been the easiest ones by comparison. Many of them have gone to long-term care facility residents and healthcare professionals at their workplaces, making it relatively simple to find eligible subjects for their first and second dose. Next week, on April 5, vaccine eligibility opens to all Iowans age 16 and older. While vaccine supply is increasing, the opening of eligibility means it will likely remain difficult for jab seekers to find workable appointments. Several independent and government resources are available to help Iowans locate vaccine appointments, including the state's VaccinateIowa.gov website provides information about vaccine availability. The 211 hotline is staffed with vaccine navigators to assist in scheduling appointments. It's available by phone at 211 or call 800-244-7431. A Vaccine Hunter website posts available vaccine appointments at www.brady-software.com/vaccinehunter. As we enter this next stage in the coronavirus pandemic, it's important to connect underserved populations to public health resources. Unsurprisingly, racial and ethnic minority groups who are poorly served by the healthcare system in general are falling through the cracks in vaccine rollout. Only about 1% of Iowa's vaccine doses so far have gone to Black Iowans, while they make up about 4% of the population. Similarly, Hispanic and Latino Iowans have received less than 2% of doses, but make up about 6% of the population. While the vaccines hold great promise, we're not there yet. Iowa's COVID-19 positivity rate is creeping back up after showing great progress in recent weeks. It's crucial that unvaccinated Iowans continue to take the same stringent health precautions we've been practicing for months. To use a football analogy, we're at the goal line on third down with seconds left on the clock. There is no time to punt. And again, that was the Gazette's own editorial. And moving now to the guest column, lawmakers make Iowa less attractive. When Governor Kim Reynolds announced in January that she would not reintroduce her Invest in Iowa package this legislative session, environmental advocates expressed our disappointment at not having an opportunity to work on funding the decade-old, still empty, Natural Resource and Outdoor Recreation Trust Fund. However, we understood the legislature would have many pandemic-related issues to address, such as expanding the state's public health infrastructure and providing economic relief to Iowans in need. We even hoped that an economic recovery package might include support for Iowa's outdoor recreation industry and state parks, given the explosion in use this past year. Unfortunately, our naivete in those beliefs was quickly exposed. Within the next few days of the session, it was clear state leadership was not interested in addressing issues affecting Iowans. Instead, the legislature has focused on a truly astounding number of narrow-minded, vindictive pieces of legislation at the behest of special interest groups and national think tanks. Rural revitalization, workforce recruitment, and economic opportunity have long been touted as priorities. However, legislation put forth this session has flown in the face of those priorities, and policy changes that could advance them have been ignored. The legislature has chosen to inhibit rights of Iowans and put our state at a competitive disadvantage by advancing legislation that would, among other things, prohibit tenure at public universities, reduce voting access, penalize social media companies that impose rules against abusive content, allow housing discrimination, and prohibit honest discourse on racism and sexism at public institutions. Meanwhile, the Governor's Economic Recovery Advisory Board released its recommendations in February for addressing challenges resulting from the pandemic. A notable recommendation is to create an environment to attract and retain Iowans by transforming communities through placemaking and investing in water quality. Just last month, the Iowa Business Council called Iowa's lack of workers bordering on a crisis. One of the main reasons friends and peers of mine have moved away from Iowa is the lack of opportunity to enjoy outdoor recreation. This is due to both the parity of public lands and green spaces in our state and diminished recreation opportunities due to Iowa's poor water quality. This is not just anecdotal. One survey showed that 1 in 5 millennials might not move to a new city for a promising job opportunity if it lacks outdoor recreation. The latest news coming from the legislature leads even more of my peers to question whether Iowa is the right place for us. The legislature's work has created an unwelcoming and hostile atmosphere to current and prospective Iowans. Issues of the environment, justice, and equality are interrelated. How we treat our environment reflects how we treat our most valuable and marginalized communities. Among the strategies to create an environment to attract and retain Iowans should be a focus on policy that creates a welcoming, inclusive state. Instead of focusing on petty, cruel, and discriminatory policies, Iowa lawmakers should focus on proactive legislation to advance shared priorities and create a truly attractive place to live. That guest column today was contributed by Alicia Basto, who is Water Policy and Advocacy Specialist with the Iowa Environmental Council. In one letter to the editor today, "With Congress broken, we're on our own to take on issues." Being a politician is no longer an admirable job. Most serve their own interests or those with deep pockets. The days of them fighting for your rights and seeking equality and justice are all over. Case in point, the Republican Party represents about 37% of Americans in Congress, yet their decisions impact every American. It's all a reality show based on out-of-control egos and a lust for power. It's time for people to come together on their own. We can count on each other. Family, friends, neighbors, strangers, we can disagree on strategies to make this country better, but at the end of the day, we do what's right for most people because we have a vested interest in leaving a positive mark on this world. Gun control, environmental protections, clean water, racial equality, gender protections, and term limits are just a few of the issues we should all come together on. Don't let politics stir the pot. They say what they say to ignite emotions. Be critical thinkers. Practice a kind act every day. Be open-minded. Walk in other people's shoes. Send a message that community is stronger than any self-serving talking point. We can do so many great things when we make decisions based on compassion for others. And that is signed by Jim Berger from Cedar Rapids. You're listening to the reading of the Cedar Rapids Gazette for today, Thursday, April 1st. On Iris. Now let's turn to today's obituaries. In the short notices from Belle Plaine, Margaret, known as Peggy Louise Daniels, age 71, died Wednesday, March 31st. The Hrabic Newhouse Funeral Service in Belle Plaine is assisting. In Cedar Rapids, Rosetta Tyson, age 80, died Tuesday, March 30th. Murdoch Linwood Funeral Home and Cremation Service, Cedar Rapids. In Iowa City, Dolores Ann Crawford, age 85, died Saturday, March 27. The Lansing Funeral and Cremation Service is in charge. And in Vinton, Timothy, known as Tim Kemp, age 65, died Tuesday, March 30th. The Van Steenhuis Russell Funeral Home in Vinton is assisting. Moving now to the regular notices. From Cedar Rapids, Florence, known as Flo Shoemaker, age 92, of Cedar Rapids, passed away Monday, March 29, in Johnston, surrounded by family. Visitation will be held from 4 to 7 p.m. Monday, April 5, at the Cedar Memorial Chapel Stateroom. Funeral services will take place at 10:30, Tuesday, April 6, at St. Mark's Lutheran Church, 8300 C Avenue in Marion. Burial will follow at Cedar Memorial Park Cemetery. A live stream of the funeral service may be accessed on St. Mark's Lutheran Church website under stmarkssCR.org. In Cedar Rapids, Carolyn May Leary, age 79, died on Tuesday, March 30, at her home. TN Funeral Home is serving the family. no details are included in the obituary. The TN Funeral Home is in charge of arrangements. From Cedar Rapids, Ronald Landeser, Sr., age 79, died at 6:43 a.m., March 31st, at Ottumwa Regional Health Center. His body has been cremated. Interment will be in Memorial Lawn Cemetery at a later date. In lieu of flowers, memorials may be made to Last Hope Animal Rescue in Cedar Rapids. And in Vinton, Betty Jean Keyes, age 71, died Tuesday, March 30th at her home from a sudden illness. A celebration of life will be held at a later date. TN Funeral Home is serving the family. In Belle Plaine, Norma Jean Chilcote, age 85, Belle Plaine, passed away March 30th at Brooklyn Community Estates in Brooklyn. She was preceded in death by her parents and her husband. Private family service will take place at a later date. Memorials may be directed to the family. Online condolences can be sent at the newhousefuneralservice.com website. From Mesa, Arizona, David Allen Lindner, age 58, of Mesa, formerly from Cedar Rapids, passed away March 24 in his home. There will be a service from 11 a.m. to 2 p.m. April 17 at Falcon Field Park, Ramadas 5 and 6. That's at 4800 East Falcon Drive in Mesa, Arizona. Moving now to the sports page. Boys Tennis has a story by Mike Condon. Kyle Lassen has competed against some of the best players in the state of Iowa during his high school tennis career. While there still are many good players remaining, the 2021 season could be the year Lassen, who is a senior at Cedar Rapids Jefferson, finally gets his chance to shine. As a freshman and sophomore, Lassen played against the likes of Rami Sheets, Cedar Rapids Washington, and Luke Van Donsleer from Linmar, both playing tennis at the NCAA Division I level now, and Rami Hamaden, Cedar Rapids Kennedy, who plays a D2-3 school powered by Co. "I'm not sure anybody in the conference is going to be playing at that level this year," said Jayhawks coach Tim Preston. Kyle having the chance to compete against those guys early was both a great challenge as well as a look at the time and commitment it takes to get to that level. Lassen was 10-5 in singles and 15-4 in doubles as a sophomore in 2019. He would have been one of the top players in the area last season if not for COVID-19 forcing the season to be canceled. "Losing last year's season was saddening, but I've managed to practice relatively consistently throughout the year and have even gotten a good amount of matches in," he said. For the first couple of months of the pandemic, however, my options for hitting were very limited. "I remember setting up a rope to act like a net against my garage wall so that I would hit ground strokes and slices off the wall." Lassen also had the advantage of being able to practice with his sister Emma, who plays number one singles for Co. "As soon as I found outdoor courts that were open, my sister and I would take a bucket of balls and run drills with each other fairly consistently," he said. "Overall, I was happy with how often I was able to practice." Preston believes Lassen is in position to have a strong senior season. And in boys tennis, here are some teams and players to watch. In the team category, Cedar Rapids Jefferson, coach Tom Preston has a team loaded with potential. At Cedar Rapids Xavier, coach Jim Potts has the luxury of having a veteran team that has won a state championship. Six players return from the 2019 Class 1A title run, putting them in prime position to defend the crown. And in another category, Iowa City West, the dynasty is West tennis looks likely to continue in 2021. Coach Mitch Gross, in his 20th season at West, is two dual victories shy of 300 for his career. The Trojans rolled to the 2019 state title, their sixth in eight seasons. In fact, West has been in every state team duel since 2011. Players to watch are Brady Horstman, Jr. from Cedar Rapids Xavier. He had an 8-7 record as a freshman for the 2019 1A state team. And from Iowa City West, probably not going to say this name correctly, Mukundan Kastrarinangan. He was undefeated in singles as West won the state team title and combined with junior with a junior, Luca, to finish sixth in two-way doubles. Cedar Rapids Jefferson's Kyle Lawson is a senior and finished 10-5 in the singles in 2019. Matthew Schmidt from Cedar Rapids Xavier, also a senior, was a state runner-up with Wesley Johnson in the doubles in 2019 and had 12-3 singles record for the defending 1A state champions. From Iowa City West, Eli Young, also a senior, was a 2A state doubles runner-up in 2019. And from Cedar Rapids, Washington, Grayson Zylstra qualified for state doubles as a sophomore. Zylstra had success playing in non-high school tournaments over the past year and should be among top singles players in 2A this season. Moving over to the living page, sound the alarm, it's time to return to the tick-tock. This by Katie Mills Giorgio. A fixture of the Cedar Rapids restaurant scene is back, and as many fans would say, it's about time. The TikTok, located on 17th Street in Northeast Cedar Rapids, reopened its doors earlier this month, and owner Corey Nanke said customers, new and old, are already flocking in. "We're getting great feedback from people," said Nanke, noting they are particularly excited that the TikTok now opens at 7 a.m. to serve breakfast. The article is accompanied by several photos. Richard Snow and John Vary, both of Cedar Rapids, catch up Monday at the TikTok in Cedar Rapids. The bar reopened this month and already has proved popular. "We're getting great feedback," Corey Nanke said. Also accompanied is a photo of cheese logs, a popular food from the old menu, makes their comeback at TikTok in Cedar Rapids. The old bar has reopened under new ownership with a new interior and TikTok classics on the menu. Also pictured is a photo of the TikTok located at 617th Street Northeast in Cedar Rapids. It got a makeover on the inside and the outside. New owners bought the property in April of 2018 after it sat vacant for some time. "We were just waiting for the right time to open," Corey Nanke said. "It's a good feeling, as getting to reopen has been quite the journey. We did a 100% remodel," said Nanke, noting that working with general contractor Eric Oberbrockling was a great experience. "There's a new kitchen, new bathrooms, a new bar, and new flooring. Plus, they are working on plans to begin construction soon on a patio for outdoor dining. And while the space may look transformed, customers looking for something of the TikTok classics when it comes to dining won't be disappointed. I always love the menu, especially the homemade cheese logs and cup night," Nanke said, noting that keeping some of the traditions was important as they thought about reviving the TikTok. "Most of the menu are TikTok classics," he said. "That includes the hand-breaded mozzarella cheese logs, sautéed mushrooms, smoked wings, the Rolex burger with sautéed mushrooms and Swiss cheese, Glenn's chicken sandwich with dill sauce, smoked ribs, and the tacos section, with your choice of steak and chorizo, barbacoa, fajita, chicken, or carnitas." While the menu is small to get started, Nanke said his staff, including manager Haley Washburn and Jared and Ryan Bly, who are running the kitchen, is excited about expanding the menu in coming months. Slow and steady has, in fact, been the name of the game on this reopening. Nanke, along with his wife Candy and brother Kevin, who also co-own the restaurant, actually purchased the TikTok in April of 2018 at auction after the property had already sat vacant for some time. "We were just waiting for the right time to open," he said, noting that the pandemic brought a significant delay to the process. They also were working to keep their other restaurants, including Kickstand, Midtown Station, Boston Fish, and the Red Frog, going as well. "I love the location between Coe College and Mount Mercy University," Nanke said. "There have been major improvements made by Mount Mercy with their athletic facilities, including the football, softball, and baseball fields. It's exciting to see all the people in the area, and I'm proud to have it reopened in the neighborhood." The TikTok is open for dining in the restaurant 7 a.m. to midnight and later on weekends, as well as carry out. Nanke said they hope to offer delivery soon. Regardless, customers will likely agree that the TikTok's reopening was well worth the wait, and Nanke hopes that many people will be creating new memories in the cherished neighborhood spot. It has a rich history, and we're excited about its future, Nanke said. Moving over to the Business 380 page for those who might be interested in travel, this story from the Minneapolis Star-Tribune, Delta to unlock middle seats in May. Delta Airlines will unblock its middle seats in May, marking the end of social distancing on all U.S. carriers and signaling a turning point in pandemic-era travel. The Atlanta-based carrier will begin selling every seat on its airplanes on May 1 and is reintegrating a number of pre-pandemic features of air travel. The company marketed itself early on in the pandemic as a health and safety airline of choice. It was one of the first and longest to block middle seats, as well as disinfecting aircraft with electrostatic sprays between flights and prepackaging snacks and beverages. Delta, which flies to the Eastern Iowa Airport in Cedar Rapids, has been the slowest among U.S. carriers to lift restrictions. Wednesday's litany of announcements signals a turning point in the pandemic as travel is anticipated to increase throughout spring and summer. And despite consumer confidence growing as the percentage of vaccinated populations expands, CEO Ed Bastian was measured in his statements regarding the changes on Wednesday. Don't confuse these actions with a return to normal. We're still operating in a pandemic, and many of the changes we've made over the past year, such as strengthening our cleaning protocol and eliminating change fees, will be permanent, Bastian said. Importantly, he added, masks will remain critical to the reopening of the skies, and crews will continue to enforce that requirement. In April, Delta will reintroduce a scaled-back version of its in-flight food and beverage service, with mini cans of Coke products and already mixed cocktails. The airline said this program was designed in partnership with Minnesota's Mayo Clinic, which has advised the company throughout the COVID-19 crisis. Its airport lounges gradually will reopen and expand their food and drink options beginning in May through July. Our internal research shows that 64% of Delta customers anticipate having at least one dose of a vaccine by May 1, increasing to 75% by Memorial Day, Bastian said. Also on the Business 380 page, Deere Foundation to invest $200 million, funds to be distributed over the next decade. The John Deere Foundation said Wednesday it will invest $200 million over the next 10 years to aid not-for-profits and initiatives focused on supporting poor farmers around the globe, as well as families and youth in its home communities who have struggled to make ends meet and to access online learning during the pandemic. As part of its 10-year commitment, the foundation, the philanthropic arm of John Deere, will invest $100 million to support youth and families with a focus on youth education. The foundation hopes to aid at least 1 million underserved and underrepresented youth through its investment, according to a news release. The investment also includes a $2 million annual investment to food banks that will provide the equivalent of 100 million meals over the next decade. Also, $50 million to help 15 million smallholder and resource-constrained family farmers throughout the world to make a living and feed a growing global population through its work with a range of global partners. And $50 million in John Deere's workforce to further mobilize and build on their volunteerism. With the impact of the COVID-19 pandemic and the tragedies that have been suffered over the last year, those things have proven to us that we must all do more to assist people, particularly those who do not have access to resources and opportunities they need to prosper, John Deere Foundation President Nate Clark said. By increasing our annual investment to $20 million per year, we think we're in an opportunity to help folks that have pretty significant needs today. Clark said the foundation will track and report investments against relevant targets and indicators aligned with the United Nations Sustainable Development Goals. In the coming months, the foundation will announce several key grants as part of its new 10-year commitment, Clark said. Since its founding in 1948, the foundation has awarded more than $340 million in grants. Moving back to a few Iowa Today stories from PrimCar, Iowa man pleads to OWI in a fatal crash. A northwestern Iowa man has pleaded guilty to driving under the influence in a 2019 crash that killed another man. Joshua Maller, 42, of Sutherland, pleaded guilty last week in O'Brien County District Court to a first offense of operating while intoxicated, a serious misdemeanor, the Sioux City Journal reported. Under the terms of the plea, Maller was sentenced to a suspended term of 180 days in jail. Maller will spend 60 days on electronic monitoring a year of probation and pay a $1,250 fine. Investigators have said Maller was driving a sport utility vehicle on October 6, 2019, when he hit an off-road utility vehicle driven by 61-year-old Jerome Schuler. Schuler was killed and two boys aged 6 and 8 riding with him were injured. Blood and urine samples taken after the crash showed that Maller was under the influence of controlled substances, investigators said. Also from the Iowa Today page, changes to the Iowa bottle bill likely a non-starter this year. A district court judge has tossed Iowa grocers' challenge to the Department of Natural Resources rule requiring retailers to redeem the nickel deposits on pop and beer containers. At the same time, a Senate committee weighing changes to Iowa's bottle bill was told the issue is dead for this legislative session. In the lawsuit, the Iowa Grocer Industry Association argued in Polk County District Court that the DNR did not have authority to require retailers to redeem deposit containers. The trade group filed suit after the DNR rejected its petition to remove the convenience standard that required retailers to sign an agreement with a DNR-approved redemption center that is no more than a 10-minute drive from their stores before they can refuse to redeem the beer and pop cans and bottles they sell. Removing that standard would essentially gut the consumer convenience standard, according to Cleaner Iowa, which asked the court to uphold the DNR's rulemaking authority. Judge Jeannie Vaught found the grocer's request would directly harm consumers and that such a significant change to the bottle bill would be best left to the legislature. That appears unlikely in the current session, as lawmakers and players in the bottle bill debate aired their concerns and frustration over the lack of a viable solution at the Capitol. Members of a Senate Ways and Means subcommittee heard pros and cons of Senate File 470, a multi-pronged proposal that backers say is the closest thing to an idea that has hope of reaching the governor's desk this session. The bill would allow grocery stores and other retailers to opt out of state requirements to accept empty nickel deposit beverage containers they sell, effective July 1. If an authorized redemption center is within 20 miles of the business. The measure would also change the redemptive process for cans and bottles and would have the state's Alcoholic Beverages Division oversee the redemption center reimbursements. Everyone is coming to us with different problems and saying the status quo is not working, said subcommittee chair Senator Dan Dawson, Republican from Council Bluffs. Brad Epley, who represents grocers at the Capitol, said all the players seeking to hammer out a compromise were told by key House members the plan was a non-starter. He did not divulge details, but told the Senate panel, "We'll continue to work on this bill since what we agreed to is a dead letter in the House." Jess Mosier of the Sierra Club said the solution has been evasive because no one has included average Iowans who overwhelmingly love the bottle deposit law in the discussion. Those Iowans, she said, favor having the law cover more containers, raising the per container deposit from 5 cents to a dime, raising the handling fee a penny to 2 cents, and maintaining the convenience of returning empties to their place of purchase. Subcommittee members forwarded the bill to the full Senate Ways and Means Committee, where Dawson said senators will try to rework the language to give it a fresh breath of life. Iowans do like the bottle bill, Dawson said, but just because we like something doesn't mean that we can pass an unfunded mandate when we know the current system is not sustainable and is collapsing. And that does it for the reading of the Cedar Rapids Gazette for today on IRIS. I've been your reader, Kathleen. You can access the reading online at iowaradioreading.org anytime. Thanks for listening and have a great, safe day.
Some would call 88-year-old Sally Jackson a lucky senior.
A few years ago, a family member offered to move in and care for Sally so that she wouldn't have to leave the comfort of her own home.
But soon after, one of Sally's neighbors, Carol, paid a visit, unannounced.
Something wasn't quite right.
Sally's demeanor and physical appearance had changed.
Luckily, Carol was aware of warning signs that might signal elder abuse.
Such as bruises, poor hygiene,
isolation, depression,
appearing withdrawn or unusually quiet, as if to hide something.
When victimized, elderly people often feel ashamed, confused.
But an alert neighbor helped Sally.
Not all abused seniors are as lucky as Sally Jackson.
McGruff the Crime Dog here. The National Crime Prevention Council wants to help you and your loved ones prevent elder abuse. Know what to look for. Know how to report it to local law enforcement agencies.
To learn more, go to ncpc.org/seniors. That's ncpc.org/seniors. A message from the National Crime Prevention Council and the U.S. Department of Justice.